Hi, it's Evan from Good Food. Before we start this week's show, I have a big announcement. KCRW has decided to cancel this Sunday's Good Food Pie Fest. We are aware of the campus protests at UCLA and believe it's in the best interest for all to cancel. Bakers, I understand how beautifully you embrace this gathering and how seriously you take the competition aspect. We see you at markets looking for the best fruit and watch you on social sharing your ideas and excitement. It's why I love this Pie Center community we've created. Thank you to everyone who poured their heart into preparing for this year's event. We will keep you posted on any updates on our social media channels. And now, on to the show. From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. The last time I sat down with Chef Dookie Hong and journalist Matt Rodbard was 8 years ago upon the release of their book, Koreatown, which explored the rise in popularity of Korean food across the U.S. Proving Korean food knows no borders, they've widened their lens on the cuisine with their latest venture, Korea World. Welcome back, you two.
Thanks for having us, Evan.
Thank you so much, Evan.
I'm so happy to have you. I mean, there's been no slowing down of the reach of Korean cuisine across the globe. As a person who, you know, is really lucky to live in a city that has just a huge Korean diaspora with all of the amazing food that that entails, I mean, to me, you can't divorce the food from the huge explosion of Korean pop culture globally. I mean, music and film, it's permeated our own culture.
Well, of course, this is Matt. And, you know, the gateway has been significant from the film industry and from television. And obviously, if you scroll on Netflix and you look at your grid, you're going to see something from Korea. And for a country of only 50 million people, the soft power, so to speak, coming out of Korea is tremendous. I mean, the global influence of the cinema and film industry, or the cinema and television industry. So with food, we're seeing a similar globalization and interest, and we cover it not just in Korea, but in America. And really with the book, we were really attempting, and I believe we succeeded in crystallizing a modern Korean cuisine or modern Korean vocabulary for food. And it's not the canon. It's not the barbecue. It's not gamjetang. It's not the so-called uncle food that we wrote about in Koreatown almost a decade ago. This book really kind of captures the modern spirit of Korean cuisine. And really through the recipe list, it's pretty different than some may think.
I know. I find it really interesting, this interplay between cuisines that are represented by kind of ossified versions that were created and remembered by immigrant home cooks, which often is the first wave of restaurants that we see when immigrants move to the U.S. But then there's the reality of how food constantly changes in the home place.
Yeah, I mean, it's so right. I mean, the home kitchen is not all about tang and guk and jjigae, so to speak. It's about V60 pour overs and Gilgari toast, which is a recipe Dookie developed, inspired by Queens up in San Francisco. So a lot of the recipe list is pulled from our experience traveling in Korea and through America. And of course, Dookie's experience, lived experience, as a Korean American chef, and really the great change in the cuisine. I mean, I feel like, you know, our coffee section and bakery section in Korea World really says something. It says that the modern Korean cuisine is not ossified, as you say. It is moving. It is at the speed of light. And really what we did with our stories throughout the book, our Citizens of Korea World, we captured the essence of this change through modern food.
Can you explain the concept of Hallyu?
Yeah, Hallyu or Korean wave, the literal translation I would say is the Korean wave. It's a cultural phenomenon. Why is, you know, a bunch of non-Koreans dancing in the streets of London, dancing in the streets of Brazil to Korean K-pop music? Why are my friends that have nothing to do with anything Korean, they're no association with Korean, telling me about the latest Korean drama that came out on Netflix, right? Even when I don't know. And this probably like was really hitting, maybe started in the 90s, but really hit maybe in the last 10 15 years, and then it really got this boost the last 5 years and 6 years, and that's why we really felt compelled to document it one more time.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much. I have to say that, you know, one reason why I love Korean, you know, soaps is the food. And I feel like I'm a fly on a wall watching what is actually happening when people go out to eat in Korea or make food at home. And it's just so enjoyable. And
are you a Dr. Wu fan?
Oh, my God.
You love it?
So much.
Isn't it great? I mean, Kimbap, just the way Kimbap comes alive with that show. And to your, I love your point. It's so accurate. It's like the food and the way it's served in Korea. And Duke and I have been really fortunate to go to Korea many times. It's quite different from even Los Angeles, which is truly the epicenter in America of Korean cuisine. It's so different. And like Professor Wu gets you really excited about Korean food. It's such a great observation. Mm.
So can you kind of dig down into that difference and maybe pick one menu item or a range of dishes?
I think we each can take one. I'll take one to start. I think the difference is this. In Korea, it's not Korean food. It's dinner or it's lunch or it's late night or it's a snack. And I think what we've done is we've crystallized these recipes that have been, some of them have been fad. So we go over like dalgona, which was a big fad a few years ago. But we have a dish like rose tteokbokki, which is a traditional tteokbokki rice cake dish, but with the you know, the inclusion of cream in the sauce, which we saw in Korea quite a bit. Another is like vongole. Like we've seen exploding interest in Italian cuisine in Korea, and we have a vongole recipe in a Korean book, which, you know, I think is probably the only Korean book with vongole recipe, but it made a lot of sense for us. So it's this idea that modern Korean cuisine doesn't really know any kind of stricture, it really is expanding at the speed of light.
So that vongole, Duki, is it a traditional vongole or is there a twist?
Yeah, I would say, and this is kind of akin, I would say, to maybe even why Japanese people talk about, or like people talk about Tokyo pizza and whatnot. It's a very influence from just, and we're going back to the globalization, the flow of information. I can, with the tip of my fingertips, know exactly what's happening in Italy and the vongole over there. Koreans the same. I know exactly what's happening, not in Korea as a whole, but that region, that town, like what they do. And I think the Korean vongole per se is, I would say, I mean, strong garlic presence, but ingredient-wise, very Italian. It's just kind of how hard you put the garlic up front, which Koreans love garlic, Asians love garlic, and how back you put kind of the olive oil because of that kind of that. In Korean, it's called nukki, which we're not like that oiliness. We're not maybe too big fans of. So we'll put it to the back seat instead of the passenger seat. So ingredient-wise, very similar. Clams, like beautiful, fresh ingredients. But it's not like, hey, it's vongole and here's kimchi on top of it. That's not what we're talking about. It's really Koreans even being like, hey, this is the best vongole, Italian dish. We recognize that it's an Italian dish and its roots, but we like to eat it this way.
Yeah, we had these breakthroughs throughout our trips and travels. We would go to Jeju or Gangwon-do. We went to Jeolla-do and experienced some temple cuisine there. But we were surprised around every corner about how our interpretation of Korean cuisine was changing almost in real time.
There's this one page you have in the book, the 17 best things we ate in Seoul and around Korea. Could you pick something else from that list and kind of break down kind of the evolution of it away from the traditional, or if it's something like brand new?
Yeah, I could take one and then Duki maybe take the next one. So one that really stuck out to me was at this restaurant, Hojokban, which there's actually a location in New York City now, and they're doing kimbap, but with a truffled tuna mayo. And to me, the idea that kimbap is, and we see it in K-dramas as we mentioned, kimbap can be so many different things. And to bring truffles, which even like 10 years ago or even 5 years ago was only reserved for the like Pierre Garnier's restaurant in Seoul. But now like truffle mayo is part of kimbap. And it had a really nice, finely ground perilla powder on top of it. And like the kimbaps too were half the size of what you would find, you know, on 32nd Street in New York or out on Olympic Boulevard in LA. It's very different. It's like almost like a fine dining version. But when it came down to it, this was like only 10,000 won, which is about $8 a serving. So the point with this dish is that it really illustrates how like Western cuisine and Western sensibilities are being done in Korea in a way that I wouldn't call it fusion. It's its own kind of way now, and it's exciting.
Mm.
Dookie, could you talk about the moo kimchi granita?
Yeah, that's a recipe that I've come up with a long time ago, actually, more than 10 years ago. And it was my influence working in Centrico, which I guess not a lot of people know with Chef Aaron Sanchez. And the idea of hot, cold, like temperature being a source of flavor, a vehicle for sensation and whatnot. So it's not just sweet, salty. It's like, okay, we can play with temperature as well. And for me, the muri kimchi granita, a lot of people kind of ignore the liquid that comes out, the beautiful, beautiful cabbage kind of liquid or the muri kimchi liquid that comes out. Decided to freeze it, granita, learning that technique from Centrico and applying it to oysters, applying it in noodle dishes. I think Korean cuisine, we play with temperature really well, like hot kalbi, hot Korean barbecue with cold noodles, even with the granita, cold on really cold, you know. So let's have a fresh cold oyster and let's put an even colder shaved ice granita.
Yeah, I just love that idea so much of this icy, icy kimchi, because I love the icy, icy soups.
You get
noodles.
It.
So you write that a visit to Jeju Island, which is referred to as the Hawaii of Korea, changed the way that you prepare fish at home. What did you learn and from whom?
what an adventure, Dookie, we had. Do you remember?
Yeah. I mean, Maddie, you share way better about this part, but I'll add on.
Okay. So, Evan, we were in Jeju Island, which, again, is the Hawaii of Korea. Everyone should go there. It's really its own, has its own foodways. They have this famous black pork, but they also have a horse meat tradition, which we tried, which was a little bit more mild than you'd imagine. But really, we were driving around and found this little seaside restaurant that was doing a whole, it was kind of like a porgy fried.
Mm.
And what we saw them do really gave us this idea for the recipe, which was they brought the fish to our table fried, and they drizzled on this gochujang-based sauce, which was kind of like the gochujang you would get with like a Korean fried chicken. And instead of it being served delicately and having each customer pick apart the whole fish as you would at any restaurant, the owner put on some gloves, some plastic gloves, and proceeded to literally smash this entire fish, breaking up the meat from the bone. And we were like, this is crazy. But then when they left it, we were like, this is actually amazing, because it's really given us this easy way to enjoy the fish. And really, it separated the flesh from the bone, but it also created this like kind of like bibimbap. It was like a little bit of a mixed vibe. I mean, Dookie, what else did you take from that?
I mean, outside of the flavors, it was, I mean, the presentation piece of it and the joy of that, the textures, like even those cartilages you're eating. And it was actually really good. I mean, I think the sauce was incredible, but it could apply to any sauce. It was just that way of eating that I felt was, okay, like we're in the middle of essentially nowhere. There's no signs here. There's no like Yelp rating here. And these, this couple, I remember it was like my parents' generation couple, like this is all they do. Like every table has this fish and it's this presentation piece. It's the texture. It's the familiarity of fried, but not familiarity of like, hey, I'm okay. I'm picking out the bones as well. Yeah. It was kind of eye opening for me.
That dish is, I just love the photograph.
Yeah.
It like gives you, it gives you permission, you know?
I like that.
Yeah. We love the recipes in the book. We think it's actually quite doable. I think frying a whole fish with a cast iron pan and really it's easier than you think. And it's just such a set piece for a dinner party, I'd say.
So I would love it if you would tell us what chefs or cooks should we be paying attention to now here in LA?
I mean, Evan, this question is so loaded. We have so many friends You are blessed with some of the most talented people in the world. So Dookie, I'm just going to say a couple names and you can say a couple names and we'll go back and forth. I mean, I think we've got the folks at Yongban. Yongban's just doing just something that is hard, which is the panchan that is transcending any panchan I've ever had, using pears and acidity. And I think Perilla, what Jihee is doing down in that cool little spot down on the east side, and I'm not sure she's been on your show, but I think Perilla as like a concept is really modern in that it's a daytime cafe doing doshirak, like box lunches, but also this incredible panchan shop.
Yeah, to put a pastry mix in there, one of my favorite cafes is Smoking Tiger. And they're more in the OC, right? So just to give a little greater Los Angeles love, Smoking Tiger, one of my favorite spots, really big Korean influence, incredible drinks. Like shamelessly, Korean is in the forefront. Misukaru, injarmi, they don't shy with it. Even their pastries, they put a yakgwa, which is a very, very traditional, like our parents' generation eats this dessert. And it's on top of like a croissant. They just do things really like, if you had to say, this is a Korean cafe, I would say Smoking Tiger really embodies that and our good friends over there.
Perfect. Oh, that's so great. It has been so wonderful to get to have this time to hang out with you guys and talk about this passion that you've expressed in Korea World.
Evan, such an honor to be on your show. We love what you do, and it's just really great to talk Korean food in the center of Korean food in America, at Los Angeles.
Evan, thank you so much.
That was San Francisco-based chef Dookie Hong and journalist and editor Matt Rodbard. We've been discussing their follow-up to Koreatown, Korea World, a cookbook. We've got a recipe for their Korean-style vongole on our website, as well as a link to buy tickets for their launch party happening this Friday, May 3rd. If you listen to the show via podcast, you might not realize that Good Food is a part of KCRW, an NPR station based in Santa Monica, California, and we share our airwaves with a whole slate of incredible culture shows. On Life Examined, host Jonathan Bastian covers issues surrounding philosophy, science, faith, and humanity. This week's episode features a wide-ranging conversation with journalist and author Michael Pollan. He discusses everything from psychedelics to coffee to the new documentary, Food Inc. 2. Here's a clip.
The fact is that food produced by an industrial system is cheaper than food produced humanely, sustainably. And part of that is we don't force the food companies, the big food companies, to pay all the costs of growing food the way they are. You know, a city of 500,000 or a million people has to clean up its waste. A feedlot of, you know, 50,000 head of cattle doesn't have to clean up its waste. You know, we had this expression, make the polluter pay. And this was a founding idea of the environmental movement, that if your way of doing business is adding pollution to the environment, you were responsible. That's not true in the food system. So the problem with getting these food companies to actually pay for the pollution and other costs to society of the way they produce food is it will increase the price of food. And that's never politically popular. Anything that increases the price of food is anathema to politicians. Going back to the French Revolution, I mean, you lose your head if that happens.
You can listen to the full episode by searching for Life Examined in whatever platform you use to stream your podcasts. And if you're in Southern California, you can catch Life Examined every Sunday at 9 a.m. on 89.9 FM KCRW. Can some of the best cookies in Los Angeles really come out of a gas station? Find out when Good Food continues.